This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Deadly heat ramped up across the world. Welcome back to a new season of Radio EcoShock. We begin with extreme weather expert Jeff Masters. He tells us when compounded climate disasters turn the USA upside down and what we can do to prepare. Then the first of several interviews trying to find out what caused the unexpected jump in heat. Former NASA scientist James Hansen pointed to reduction in ship emissions. We have Dr. Andrew Gettleman. He investigated and you get the verdict. Plus, headlines of global climate chaos pole to pole in the summer of 2024. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go. When will climate change turn life in the U.S. upside down? What should you do to prepare for the climate change storm? Those are blog titles from Dr. Jeff Masters. Jeff has 45 years of experience as a meteorologist, including 4 years of flying with the famous NOAA Hurricane Hunters. For 20 years, he's blogged about extreme weather and climate change, drawing millions of comments from a worldwide community of weather watchers. Jeff continues as an authoritative source on each big hurricane, but he's not just your standard meteorologist. Recently, Jeff summarized decades of experience to predict how climate change unfolds and what we can do to prepare. Jeff Masters, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Before we dive into your big picture writing, let's just talk about the eerie pause in Atlantic hurricanes. As you know, this summer, NOAA predicted above normal Atlantic hurricanes with 17 to 25 named storms, maybe 4 to 7 possible hurricanes. That has not happened yet. You just posted with Bob Henson about this. As a world expert on hurricanes, Jeff, what do you think is going on?
We don't really know what's going on, which is concerning, gratifying at the same time. We like to see a quiet hurricane season, but this one really has us scratching our heads. And the best thing we can think of is the African monsoon is not behaving as expected. It's actually pushing some record amounts of rainfall up into the Sahara Desert. So all these seedling storms that we usually see coming off the coast of Africa and spawning hurricanes, well, those are going in the Sahara Desert this summer instead, and they're triggering very heavy rains there. And when they come off of the coast of Africa, they're too far north to cause a hurricane, and they're embedded in some Saharan dust and dry air. So very unusual behavior of the African monsoon this year, and we think that's contributed to this quiet period. I mean, normally, first week of September is the busiest whole week of hurricane season, but nada. So what's going on? Well, probably it'll eventually get active again by late September. We saw a similar pause 2 years ago, 2022 hurricane season. We went 0 for August, no named storms at all. But if you recall, that season ended up in late September spawning Hurricane Ian, which hit South Florida and caused $117 billion in damage. So still early, a lot of activity ahead of us, but very unusual things going on in the tropical Atlantic this year.
But as your colleague Bob Henson notes, the Atlantic is quiet for now, but the Pacific is cooking. What have you been watching there?
We've got a tropical storm that hit the Philippines called Yagi, and that is expected to intensify into a major typhoon and hit China, Category 3 or stronger landfall, down to the coast south of Hong Kong there.
We have an unknown canyon yet to explore, an unknown river to run. What falls there may be, we know not. What walls rise over the river, we know not. What rocks beset the channel, we know not. And it wasn't at all clear that we could survive it.
I just played a quote from explorer John Wesley Powell as his team set down the unmapped Colorado River rushing through the Grand Canyon. That was 1869, and not everyone survived. Jeff, why open your article on our current situation with that quote?
Because they didn't know what was ahead of them on that famous expedition. It was an unexplored canyon, very forbidding with great depths, and they were getting deeper and deeper into the canyon. And they had to go through rapids of unknown ferocity and face some trials that were unprecedented. The great unknown, they called it, and that's kind of what we face with climate change. We've never experienced this sort of situation in human history. Climate change's challenges are unprecedented, and we don't know what's ahead of us. We know it's going to be turbulent, and we're riding in kind of a primitive boat. I mean, they had these wooden boats that were prone to accidents, and certainly the boat of civilization that we ride in is prone to such problems as well. I mean, you could already say that our boat is leaking, and we've got the worst rapids ahead of us. So I thought it was a perfect analogy.
All right, let's go to your first big question titled, When Will Climate Change Turn Life in the U.S. Upside Down? So far, America has managed to cope with life-threatening heat waves and a few historic hurricanes. Is there a point when people are so pummeled by extreme weather, the economy may not recover to so-called normal?
That point has been delayed by throwing money at the problem. I mean, essentially, I make the analogy that when you have a soldier that's wounded, and instead of fixing the underlying injury by putting him in the hospital, you just give him a blood transfusion and send him back to the front lines. So that's kind of what we're doing now. The unsustainable system is being propped up by unwise sorts of spending of money. We're building in unwise, risky places, in flood zones near the coast, on barrier islands, in the wildland-urban interface, in our forests out west, which have been experiencing more intense wildfires that are causing more destruction. And it's simply unsustainable, this sort of mad construction we're doing in risky areas, because there are too many places that we're going to need to defend all at once, too many beach nourishment programs that need to happen, too much federal bailout money is going to be needed to handle all of the increasingly severe disasters we're going to get. And it's very sobering to realize that the steep increase we've seen in disaster costs in recent decades, that's not primarily due to climate change. That's due to unwise building in risky places and for archaic insurance rules that allow us to subsidize building in these foolish places. Climate change is now ramping up, and the relative fraction of damage that is going to be due to climate change is going to severely increase in coming decades. So yes, we're going to rapidly reach the point, I think within 15 years, probably sooner, where we're going to hit the wall of reality, and there's going to be a wholesale reckoning in how we manage our risky places that we're building in.
And the first extremes are already here. Even top scientists are puzzled why so many heat records have been broken in 2023 and 24, and not just by a little, on both land and sea around the world. What do you see as the most imminent climate-driven threats for the United States coming up next, even in the next few years?
The coastal property market is teetering at the brink of insolvency in some regions. It's very difficult to even insure a home in places like Florida, Louisiana, and Texas. And that's going to continue to get worse because sea level rise is flooding the coast more and more, even on sunny days. And when you happen to get a hurricane, its storm surge now can push farther inland because it's riding up on top of higher sea levels. And now with hurricanes getting stronger, at least the strongest ones are getting stronger, you've got a double whammy of coastal damage happening. So the coastal property market is going to have a correction. We're going to see a lot of homes go down in value. A lot of people are going to try and sell. And I think it's likely to trigger a mini great financial crisis of 2008, where you suddenly lose a lot of value in the property market. And that's a systemic sort of threat to the entire economy, as we saw in 2008 with the subprime mortgage crisis. So that's the main threat I see in the near term. And it could happen any year. I mean, it could happen this year if we get unlucky and get another Hurricane Ian type storm causing $100 billion in damage to the property in Florida. Certainly by the mid-2030s, I think, that threat gets much greater because that's the time when a wobble in the moon's orbit will greatly increase high tide flooding along portions of the U.S. coast, primarily the Gulf Coast, California, and the southeast U.S. coast. So you're going to see a steep ramp up in flooding, And that's going to cause a large amount of pressure in the coastal property market through a large enough stretch of the U.S. that it simply isn't going to be able to sustain the kind of investment in prices we have now.
In your Yale Climate Connections post, you talk about black swan and gray swan extreme weather events. Can you explain a bit?
A black swan is an event we didn't see coming. I mean, not even climate models were able to predict, for instance, the unusual behavior of the jet stream we've seen in recent decades, where it grows in amplitude and freezes in place, bringing us long, extended periods of extreme weather all across the globe. Climate models are beginning to tell us that, okay, we understand that can happen, but that was a black swan type event. Another black swan event was Hurricane Sandy in 2012. We never knew that a Caribbean hurricane could merge with a mid-latitude cyclone and cause a superstorm like we saw. So crazy sorts of events are expected that we did not see coming, and those are a great concern because we don't know how to model that. Now, a gray swan event, on the other hand, you can think of as something that's unprecedented, but the climate models do see coming. So we have seen some very concerning sorts of runs of the models showing that, hey, we could get a 200-mile-per-hour hurricane hitting one of our major population centers, you know, Miami or Tampa or Houston. That would be maybe even up to $250 billion sort of blow to the economy. Also, a mega flood in California costing $1 trillion is something the climate models see as likely to happen in the next 50 years. And there are other gray swans we should anticipate in the future. Certainly, heat waves and droughts that the models are modeling are going to substantially challenge modern civilization, certainly on a global sense, and probably in the U.S. as well.
So when will Earth hit a new normal stage of climate, some plateau where we know what to expect at least?
I hear people ask me a lot, is this the new normal for extreme weather after, you know, crazy summer of extreme weather like we had this year? And I say, this is not the new normal. We will continue getting more extreme in our weather as long as we continue to pump heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, as long as we're not net zero. And the earliest we're going to be net zero under any sort of reasonable sort of climate scenario I'm looking at is the 2070s. So we're talking almost 50 years from now. The weather is going to continue to get more extreme decade after decade after decade. And even when we do stabilize the climate by getting to net zero, not burning any more fossil fuels, sea level rise is going to keep on going because that's got a long sort of tail to it. It'll continue to rise as long as the glaciers are melting, and we've probably reached the point of no return for the glaciers in Greenland, which are going to, over a period of thousands of years or maybe hundreds of years, contribute many feet of sea level rise. And in Antarctica, we're probably pushing the boundary for some of the glaciers there, particularly the ones in the West Antarctica. The Thwaites Glacier and the Pine Island Glacier are going to contribute many feet of sea level rise over a period of a few hundred years.
Your two articles are mainly about the United States, but America is no island in this globalized world. What overseas threats could come back to damage the economy and Americans?
If you've got a synchronized set of heat waves and droughts worldwide that are causing food problems in multiple grain-growing areas, so-called breadbaskets. For instance, Ukraine, Russia has a breadbasket. The United States center also, and Canadian center has a breadbasket. Also, East Asia, China, Vietnam. If you get droughts simultaneously in those three areas that reduce food production, you could get a systemic shock to the global food system that causes prices to spike, and you get political unrest, you get potential war, and it could cause a global economic correction, I mean, to the tune of perhaps $3 trillion, as modeled by Lloyd's of London. They gave a 2.8% chance of a global food shock per year occurring that would cost the global economy $3 trillion. And if you sum that up over a period of 30 years, that's like a 50-50 chance. And that assumes that the risks aren't increasing, which they are, because droughts get more intense as you warm up the climate. So really the odds of a $3 trillion food shock to the global economy are probably better than 50-50 over the next few decades.
And despite deadly heat waves and smashers like Hurricanes Katrina and Sandy, the public and politicians are barely motivated to prepare. Hurricane Sandy flooded Lower Manhattan in New York, some of the most valuable real estate in the world, and they still have not built any defenses for one of the world's most important harbors, and that was in 2012. Should we give up on the idea that the next big storm or wildfire will finally tip the public into real climate action?
You know, there have been so many extreme weather events that should have tipped the balance into making us take climate change seriously. And, I mean, we have done quite a bit. There have been a couple of laws passed in the past 4 years that have given tens of billions of dollars to fight climate change, particularly in response to doing the clean energy revolution, to electrifying the economy. So a lot of progress there, but not so much progress in adaptation, to getting ready for what is already here and for what's coming. Building our coastal infrastructure stronger, putting money into retreating from risky places, we call it managed retreat, for preparing for more intense wildfires, for our infrastructure, like bridges and dams, being subject to more extremes. We're only spending probably about less than 10% of our total money that we're spending for climate change is going towards what we call adaptation, these sort of things. More than 90% is going towards mitigation, which means emitting less greenhouse gases. So we need to do both. And we're in a reactive than a proactive sense when a big hurricane comes and wipes out, you know, Barrier Island or a major city even. We spend billions to recover from that, but we don't learn from it. We don't get smart to build smarter and stronger rather than just replace what was already there. So I'm not convinced that any disaster is going to change that thinking. And what we're headed for, the future is going to be for unplanned retreat from the coast. It's not going to be managed retreat. We're just going to flee in chaos away from the coast. And there are going to be millions of people, probably as many as 10 million people, leaving the coastal region within the next 30 years because of increased climate hazards.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With us is storm chaser and expert meteorologist Dr. Jeff Masters. We go to Jeff's second blog post at Yale Climate Connections. The title is, What Should You Do to Prepare for the Climate Change Storm? So in 2013, I spoke with Jerry Williams. She's a correspondent for EcoShock and Earthbeat Radio. Williams left a job at a local college in Washington, D.C. to move north to Wisconsin. Knowing about global warming, she decided it was time to move her family to a cooler place. It sounded to me early at the time, 2013, but as of August 28, 2024, D.C. has experienced 6 days this summer where the temperature was at least 100 degrees Fahrenheit, almost 38 C. Jeff, talk to us about the hard decisions about whether to move out of foreseeable danger.
The so-called climate havens that people have been reading about are just that. I mean, they're going to be places with cooler temperatures and water. The Great Lakes certainly are a potential climate haven. And they're going to get more and more attractive in the coming decades as the heat increases in the south and drought conditions cause water availability problems. And as people flee the coast from greater coastal storms and sea level rise. So, yes, it makes a lot of sense to leave, but do you leave sooner rather than later? That's a great question, because you should consider standing your ground, because when you leave your place you live, you're away from your web of social connections to your community, and you don't have, you know, your friends and family to help you out. You have your job potentially. So packing your bags is not something you should do lightly. And if you do pack your bags and decide to go, which absolutely you should do, I think, if you live on a barrier island, then where do you go? Well, there are a lot of tools I give in my posts about what you can do to evaluate your risk, but not every place is going to be perfect. I mean, we thought that northern Vermont, for instance, was going to be a climate haven. And if you look at one of the tools I give you, the Climate Vulnerability Index, it's got the least vulnerable mark on there. But yet, if you look at the actual number of FEMA-declared disasters over the past 23 years, northern Vermont has had 10. It ranks the highest on the number of declared disasters in the country, along with other places you might not expect, like Kentucky, and many other places like Louisiana where you would expect it. Every place has risk, and you just have to try and reduce your risk as best you can. And some of the risks are not climate risks either. You got to think about infrastructure. What city that you're moving to has good infrastructure? What has good local government? These are tough tasks to investigate, and you got to do your homework. What's the political situation like? Do they have good people in charge? All these questions need to be answered.
New science and medical research is showing wildfire smoke is much more dangerous for our health than previous generations realized. Last year, massive wildfires in Canada covered most of the northern U.S. with smoke. Jeff, what can we do to protect the health of our families in those cases?
We have to realize there is no safe level of wildfire or smoke concentrations. So you should do what you can to cut down on how much you breathe. And certainly the location you live at is a key place to decide. The western U.S. and western Canada will continue to be hotspots for wildfire activity. So living out there is going to carry hazards during wildfire season, which is getting longer and longer, the whole summer into the fall a lot of times. You need to monitor the air quality levels by consulting in the U.S., the EPA monitors. But it's smart also to put your own home monitor in your backyard. I have one called from purpleair.com that will measure the levels of particle pollution from wildfires. And I look at that all the time to judge my risk. And when it's high, I close up my windows and I turn on my indoor HEPA units. So HEPA units are basically fans attached to filters, and those filters will filter out the wildfire smoke very effectively. And it also will do the same for COVID, airborne viruses. So we're always running HEPA in my house, and we particularly crank it up when there's wildfire smoke outside. And I also have a little home air pollution monitor, just portable, that I can carry around and push the button on top, made by a little company called TempTop, that will give you your air quality index. So I take that around when I'm traveling, or actually when I go up north and camp, I take that unit with me, and I take a little portable HEPA unit with me, too, that I plug into a battery. And inside my tent, I will run my HEPA connected to an air filter to make my air better. So air purification is critical for maintaining your health, and knowing what the air quality is the other thing to be doing.
Believe it or not, I've done that myself. We booked a camping site by a beautiful lake, but you have to book way in advance. When we got there, there were 3 wildfires burning right across the lake, and I had a HEPA air filter and ran it off the solar power in our little RV. So in your review of Abram Lustgarten's book, On the Move, you look at mass migration due to extreme climate changes. In April 2023, I talked with UK science journalist Gaia Vince. She says we are entering a nomad century. There will be so much climate mass migration. Could there be even mass migration within the United States?
There will be mass migration within the United States. There will be tens of millions of people on the move. And mostly this will happen from the coast, from rising sea levels. But it will also happen from hot places, places like Arizona and southern Texas that will get unbearably hot. And it will also come from wildfire zones, places where you basically can't insure a house anymore because of the wildfire risk, or people just don't want to live out there because of the wildfire smoke. So 3 different hazards that will all put people on the move, and it's going to be tough to compete for all the places that people are going to be moving to, these more desirable, cooler places with less wildfire smoke and less flood risk are going to get priced up. And it's going to be kind of a climate gentrification issue where the rich are going to be able to afford to live where all these desirable places are. We're going to need to see a lot of affordable housing built. And this is not on anyone's radar that I see among politicians, the need to build tens of millions of units of affordable housing in some of these climate havens is absolutely something we need to get cracking on right away. and it's not happening. So mass migration is coming. We're not prepared for it. And you'd best be getting ahead of the curve while you can. You know, if you are thinking long term, moving to a climate haven with affordable housing while you can get it now is a smart thing to do.
So you're still a go-to source for journalists covering the latest weather disaster. I go to Yale Climate Connections when something big happens here. But chronicling the big ones was not enough for you. You turned decades of experience into some warning and some advice, not just for Americans, but this is need-to-know stuff, I think, for anyone, anywhere. Do you feel that you went through a change from pure meteorology to a voice for action?
Absolutely. I've decided I'm going to spend my energy now telling my friends and extended family, I mean, anyone who reads my blog, how to prepare for what's coming, because this is going to be a earth-shaking sort of transition, and it's not going to be a comfortable one. There won't be a seamless transition to a new society in balance with the climate of the 21st century. That's not possible. Had we started in the 1990s, it could have happened, but it's going to be wrenching change, and we really need to be aware of what's coming at us. And so I know as well as anyone what is coming, and what I know is still highly inadequate. It's so many unknowns because human behavior is involved, politics is involved, weather and climate are involved. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. There's a lot to take in. You should educate yourself as best you can on what's coming.
You do find some hope for the future in something called cathedral thinking. Let's wrap up with that. Tell us more.
We have to realize that what's coming at us, I think of as kind of, we rate hurricanes on a scale of 1 to 5, okay? So we talk a lot about when we pass 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming, 2 centigrade of warming, 3 centigrade of warming over pre-industrial levels, what that means. I think of, for humanity, once we cross that 1.5 degree centigrade threshold, that's like a Category 1 hurricane for humanity. When we cross the 2-degree threshold, which will probably occur around 2050, that's like a Category 3 hurricane. That'll be devastating. I mean, it's going to cause tremendous destruction, loss of life. And we need to really hold global warming below 3 degrees centigrade of warming, which I think of as catastrophic. So I don't think we have any choice. We're going to have to hold global warming below 3 degrees centigrade or all is lost. But I think that we're already in a place where we've laid the foundation of the new society we need to have in order for that to happen. That's the clean energy revolution. And we have to realize that this revolution we've started isn't something that's going to be finished in our lifetime. I mean, the cathedrals of the Middle Ages, those were multi-decade, sometimes lasted more than a century projects. So the people that are building our cathedral of the future, the clean energy society with zero emissions in balance with a new climate, we're not going to live to see that cathedral finished. But the cornerstone has been laid. We have the clean energy revolution in place, and we just have to keep building on that. And we have to contribute. Everybody's got to do their part, lay their brick, contribute to what we need to build. And there are a lot of people that have great suggestions on what you can do. Certainly, talking about climate change and getting people more aware of what's coming at us is important. Joining a climate action group is important. Supporting politicians and leaders that will do something about it. All these things need to happen. And that's how you can make your unique contribution. And obviously, reducing your carbon footprint is important. Traveling less, eating lower on the food chain, a vegan diet. All these things are things you can do to contribute to building our cathedral of the future. It's got to happen. I think it will happen. We're not going to reach a science fiction future where, you know, it'll be this post-apocalyptic thing like a Blade Runner or a Waterworld. We're going to fall short of that. We're going to make it happen. We're going to come through the climate crisis, but it's going to take 50-plus years. The weather's going to keep on getting more extreme for that long. So it's important now to elect leaders that will help make that happen. The next election cycle in the U.S. is critical for that. So buckle up. We got a raft to ride through the rapids of unknown intensity, and keep the faith. We're a lot of very smart, talented people working on this. We're going to pull through.
Jeff Masters co-founded Weather Underground in 1995. He was a flight meteorologist for NOAA. Take time to explore Jeff's recent post at yaleclimateconnections.org. And you can find links to follow up as well in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jeff, thank you so much for coming back for our listeners.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Alex.
The quote from explorer John Wesley Powell was read by American actor Clay Jenkinson for National Geographic.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Rapid headline news
from Radio EcoShock.
Here we go with as many climate chaos headlines as I can fit in a few minutes. Climate chaos around the world in just the last few months.
May.
Guardian newspaper headline, world's top climate scientists expect global heating to blast past 1.5 degrees C. Planet is headed for at least 2.5 C of heating, with bad results for humanity, poll of hundreds of scientists find. Pakistan's intense heat wave sends day temperatures over 50 degrees C, with nights of 30 degrees C and above. New study finds climate change is linked to worsening brain diseases. A University of California team uncovers vigorous melting at Antarctica's Thwaites Glacier. May 29, 2024, Delhi temperature hits highest ever in India, 52.3 Celsius, according to the Weather Bureau.
June.
June 21st, Mexico hits a searing 52 degrees C, 125.6 Fahrenheit, tying the highest temperature ever recorded in Mexico. Massive floods due to extreme rainfall in China. Heat still stuck in Pakistan. Peter Dines tweets, Karachi is one giant oven. It is near 50 degrees C temperature, stretching the limit of human survivability every day. The ambulance service delivers 30 to 40 bodies to Karachi City Morgue daily. In the last 6 days, they have collected 568 bodies, including 141, on Tuesday alone, end quote from Peter Dines. Phoenix pavement temperatures reach 160 to 170 degrees Fahrenheit, 71 to 77 C, not far from boiling. People with severe burns arrive in the emergency wards.
July.
Texans seek out power as brutal heat wave and humidity builds. Over 2 million electric customers across Texas are still without power following Hurricane Beryl, AccuWeather reports. July 16, Colin McCarthy tweets, Dubai recorded a heat index of 144 degrees Fahrenheit, 62.6 degrees C today at 3 p.m. The heat index is currently 129 degrees Fahrenheit, 53.9 C at 5 a.m. local time. It is life-threatening heat. Next day, the Acropolis in Athens is shut down again during life-threatening extreme heat. Tourists die. 100 people in Phoenix die of heat in 1 week. Washington Post, July 23. Sunday was the hottest day ever recorded on Earth, scientists say. Antarctic temperatures soar 50 degrees above norm in long-lasting heat wave. India facing a deadly heat crisis.
August.
Jeff Goodall tweets, Heat kills at least 175,000 people a year in Europe, World Health Organization says. August 26, 40 degrees Celsius in some parts of Australia. It is still winter. Colin McCarthy, one of the highest sea surface temperatures ever recorded on Earth in the Persian Gulf. The sea was almost as warm as your body, 97.7 Fahrenheit or 36.5 Celsius. August 26, Australia just experienced its hottest winter day ever recorded, topping out at an unbelievable 106.8 degrees Fahrenheit, 41.6 C. The Amazon is on fire. Smoke fills the capital, Brasilia, and even Sao Paulo. A city in Iran along the Persian Gulf, home to over 160,000 people, recorded a heat index of 152 degrees Fahrenheit, 66.7 C, according to Colin McCarthy. Strange twist, the UK had its coolest summer since 2015, according to Provisional Met Office statistics. Phoenix hits 100 straight days of 100 degree heat Fahrenheit. August 2024 ties the record for the hottest August ever recorded on this planet. We are out of time. Find this fast headline review in print, including links to most of the sources, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Are we in extreme climate danger? Will it cool off this year? What caused this incredible, long-lasting burst of heat around the world?
Radio EcoShock.
Famous climate scientist James Hansen warned warming was increasing rapidly. That was in the summer of 2021. Hansen cited inadvertent heating revealed by slashing sulfur emissions by international shipping. Then we had a string of record hot years, including the first half of 2024. No less than six teams of scientists investigated the role of shipping emissions. Could pollution controls cause the wild heat of 2023 and 24? This is important to our future and possibly for geoengineering if we need it. Dr. Andrew Gettleman is a scientist specializing in clouds and climate change. His PhD investigated pollution of the atmosphere, not by ships, but by aircraft. After working at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, Dr. Gettleman moved to the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory as a senior Earth scientist. Now Andrew develops and manages Earth system models. From Richland, Washington, Andrew Gettleman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Your new paper, published August 12th, is titled, "Has Reducing Ship Emissions Brought Forward Global Warming?" Was your team stimulated by claims from Hansen and his team?
Well, it wasn't so much Hansen's team, but it was just the general concept that suddenly the planet had warmed, and most of my team had been prepared to study the shipping emissions anyway. We actually developed models to do this, and we had a team ready to go in 2020 when the effects came along. But there were some other things that happened in 2020 that made it difficult to analyze average perturbations in the atmosphere because everything else changed. So we now came back a couple years later, and as the temperatures really went up, a number of us said, well, is there any relationship here? I actually sort of went into this thinking I was going to disprove the relationship, any relationship, that the effect wasn't large enough from our sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations.
Right, and not necessarily the results that you got. And we'll talk about those in just a minute. First, for our listeners, how could cutting sulfates from ship fuel reveal warming?
What happens is sulfates in particular are places where cloud drops like to condense. Water doesn't like to condense on its own in the free atmosphere without some help. So having sulfate around, water tends to like stick to the sulfate, and it tends to actually promote the formation of cloud drops. You can basically see this in clouds that have a lot of sulfur emissions in them. And sulfur is basically a small trace component of most fossil fuels because it's an organic material. So different types of fossil fuels have different levels of sulfur. You see it in not really in natural gas because it's pretty much pure methane, but certainly in oil and in coal, there are levels of sulfur in it. And when this goes into the atmosphere, it comes out as a gaseous form that then oxidizes and becomes a small sort of haze particle. And it promotes cloud drop formation. So all else being equal, if you had a cloud and there was a lot of sulfate present, you would tend to see more cloud drops in it.
Well, scientists talk about increased warming not in degrees, but in watts per square meter. What is watts per meter squared, and does that relate directly to temperatures we experience?
It does relate pretty directly. So watts per meter squared is energy. Specifically, it is an energy input in the form calibrated as heat, essentially joules per second. So it's a rate of energy. So it's the amount of heat over time, and it's per square meter, meaning per unit area. So it's a convenient metric to say how much heat is being added by a given process at a given rate over a particular area. And so the way that relates to temperature, obviously, is it's heat. And so the accumulation of watts per square meter over time and over square meters tends to give you a warming temperature in that location or generally as it accumulates. It's basically a measure of the rate of heat input.
And before we get to your findings, please explain for radio listeners how you tested the impacts of lower ship emissions. And also, I'm kind of interested, what happened in 2020 that made it difficult to do that?
So two things happened in 2020. In January of 2020, a long-planned regulation went into effect that required shipping companies to use a fuel that had in their ships that had lower sulfur in it. It basically put a restriction on the amount of sulfur, which was like 10 times lower than it, or 80% lower than it had been. It was a pretty large reduction. This was based on things that had already happened around the coast of North America and Europe, where within the territorial waters, starting in about 2012, the EU and the United States put similar regulations reducing the amount of sulfur, because not only does sulfur promote cloud drop formation, and when it gets in cloud drops in high concentrations, it forms acid rain, but it also can contribute to sort of haze and smog and ozone formation. So high concentrations of dirty shipping fuel around ports can create air quality problems. So the EU and the U.S. had sort of reduced the sulfur already in small regions within 200 miles of their coastline. And there was an agreement in 2016 or 2017 from the international body that governs shipping to require this everywhere, starting in January of 2020 with a three-month phase-in period. But the other thing that happened in 2020 was starting in February, the entire planet starting to get locked down due to COVID. And that changed emission patterns. It changed shipping patterns. It resulted in supply chain disruptions. So it really changed the baseline independent of anything that was happening with the shipping fuel. And that meant that obviously it was going to take a little while for all that to work itself out before we could actually assess this issue.
Totally makes sense. So how much added energy from lower ship emissions did your study find?
A very, very small amount in the grand scheme of things. And that's the thing to put in perspective. If we stopped all the shipping emissions, it's not like climate change or global warming would go away. We're talking about what we assess as being tenths of a watt per meter squared of an effect on probably something like 2 to 3 watts per meter squared of total human forcing right now. So we're looking at a few percent of the total impact. However, that's a global average, and it's a little more concentrated because it tends to happen in regions where the shipping is, which is Northern Hemisphere oceans. So in those regions, it is potentially a more significant and traceable effect.
And this brings me to a strange question. I mean, is there sort of local global warming? If you talk about regional effects in say, over the Pacific and maybe North America, but not in the Southern Hemisphere, can warming work like that?
Global warming is not uniform globally. It is a global average. And nobody really feels the global average. We see general warming. I mean, obviously the weather varies quite a bit. If you think of climate as being the distribution of weather, so you have warm days and cold days, if you take the mean or the most frequent or the most expected value, global warming tends to shift that. For example, it shifts the temperature to a slightly warmer value. But it definitely does it in differential ways. So, for example, we know that the Arctic has warmed a whole lot more than the tropics have, or even the mid-latitudes where most people live. And the impacts on things like sea ice sheets, high-latitude snow, permafrost have been pretty dramatic. And that's actually a result that's predicted by models. So warming does tend to be differential on average. And part of probably the biggest contributor to the warm temperatures over the past year was also a local effect, which is not human caused, and that's El Nino. The El Nino Southern Oscillation results in changes in the distribution of warm water in the Pacific, and it spreads the water out over a larger area and contributes to an overall a large rise in temperature and an overall slight increase in temperature in the planet, which is now going away because the El Nino has gone away.
And one of the objections to Hansen's theory was raised by Dr. Michael Mann of Penn State. He and others asked how a change to emissions in 2015 and 2020 would push extra heating 3 or 4 years later in 23 and 24. Is a delay like that possible?
It is possible, in particular because you're putting heat into the ocean, and the ocean takes a long time to warm up. It has an incredible amount of thermal mass, essentially. You can think about that, about how much, you know, if you're trying to boil water, it takes quite a bit of time to boil water. The air over a burner heats a lot faster than water in a pot over the same burner. So it means you have to put a lot more energy to heat up water. And so it does take time to do that. One of the things we looked at was how long it would take for an instantaneous warming to be felt. And if you look at a simple model of how thick the upper ocean that communicates with the atmosphere is, it does take 7 to 10 years to realize a good chunk of any instantaneous warming that happens over the ocean at the surface.
Well, in the 6 studies, findings of radiative forcing had a really wide range. Juan et al. 2024's highest estimate of 0.3 comes closest to Hansen's 0.5 watts per meter squared, but the range in Juan's group was very big, going even below your estimates. And the lowest estimate is generally Hossfather and Forster in 2023 at 0.08 watts per meter squared. Your team finds kind of a middle estimate, but even with all this study, can we say that we still aren't sure?
We've done it a couple different ways. We kind of took observations and then we took model estimates that were consistent with that. And I think our kind of work argues that from at least, especially from the sort of first principles or bottom-up modeling, it's kind of hard to get some of the larger impacts. There's a lot of uncertainty at the high end. I think it's undoubtedly going to be the effects are positive and they're greater than zero, but they're fairly small. I think more than double our triple our estimate, sort of getting up into the Juan et al. Or the Hansen et al. Stuff, I think it's going to be harder to do.
But if every expert can't be sure what happened in a test case that already happened, how can we know what geoengineering will do?
Well, I think that is one of the big problems, is that any geoengineering solutions are going to be subject to similar uncertainty, similarly large, similarly hard to verify. And I think what our study shows is that theoretically you can get some sort of small discernible effect from some of these changes from clouds, from modifying low clouds. It's not clear that the magnitude of that scales. I think there's a lot of other questions that the ships only have impacts in certain regions because that's where the clouds are. If you put a ship in a region with no clouds, you're not really going to have much of an impact.
In fact, you were a part of a team that studied the feasibility of marine cloud brightening, published in 2022. Andrew Gettleman, can that work? What is your take?
I think it's yet to be shown. I mean, the feasibility, there's two issues. One is, can you technically do it? The other one is, even if you could, what is the feasibility of how many clouds are susceptible to this, and could you actually change it? And then the third piece of that, we sort of identified all these things in that earlier study, is what are the actual effects? Because trying to offset a small amount of global warming with a large amount of regional warming, that is, if you're in pure energy terms, if you want to offset warming over the whole planet by using 1% of the area of the planet and affecting clouds over that 1% area, your effect has to be 100 times larger than the global effect. And that starts to be kind of extreme. I think that early studies have shown that it's difficult not to change the climate when you're trying to undo the warming, essentially, if you do it through localized effects.
A surprising amount of the mainstream press still lists this ship emissions cut as the major cause of recent record-smashing heat. For example, Moody's Insurance, in a recent article, points to, quote, ships, funnels, and the outcome of the International Maritime Organization regulations on sulfate emissions, end quote, as a cause. It's handy for business to blame environmental regulations for global heating. Andrew, I wonder, does this need to be debunked a little bit?
Well, our study sort of does debunk that. The planet global average warmed on the order of 1 degree centigrade, almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit or more in the last year. And our work estimates that only something like the amount of warming we're looking at is essentially 5% of that globally. Regionally, it might be 20 or 30%, but even then, it's not the dominant factor. I would say the dominant factor is interannual variability, things like ENSO, the El Nino Southern Oscillation, and ENSO warm period on top of climate change with interannual variability can certainly explain all of the warming we've seen. What we're talking about is a 5 to 10% global effect, and regionally it might be 20 to 30% over regions of the North Atlantic and North Pacific.
You were part of a group of 57 scientists saying this heat just might be from human emissions and land use changes expected all along. The study using IPCC-type tools was published in June 2024. Could you tell us just a bit about that?
I think it was arguing that we need to think about updating the data sets that we use much more frequently. We have been assessing climate on a decadal type scale, not trying to do it at a shorter time scale. And because of the changes we're seeing, and to some extent our increased capacity to actually simulate weather and climate slightly farther into the future, meaning not just the next 2 weeks, but get some information about a year or 2 years in advance, knowing actually what the emissions are right now, not 5 years ago, is helpful.
Well, I can tell you that the headline at phys.org about that study said, new study finds Earth warming at record rate, but no evidence of climate change accelerating. Now, to me, I found that totally confusing, because if the Earth is warming at a record rate, that sounds like a priori evidence of climate change accelerating.
Right. Well, I think the problem is if we don't know the actual emissions and can't constrain the human contribution, it becomes hard to do the attribution, because the last couple years have been warm, but it's still within the range of interannual variability. I think there are some other tools we're trying to use besides surface temperature that actually may give us a better indication of that. And there's going to be some work coming out on that pretty soon, I think.
Well, to my mind, there's sort of two schools envisioning the future. One expects a relentless but steady ramping up of heat, big storms, and all that, developing over decades and centuries. The other school sees climate change unfolding in steep steps, followed by temporary plateaus. We may have just gone up a step. Andrew, what do you think?
I think it's a mix of both. I think if you look at the historical record, we've already seen this. So there have been periods where the planet hasn't warmed, and there have been periods when the warming has gotten larger, and some of that may be forced warming. So a much larger change to sulfur occurred starting in about 1980, when the U.S. and the European Union decided to do something about acid rain and start constraining the amount of sulfur emissions in the atmosphere. That undoubtedly had a probably much larger warming effect than the shipping has had. But it happened over 20 years, so that may have contributed to warming from the 90s into the first decade of the 21st century. There was a period from about 2005 to 2015 where the global average mean temperature did not go up. And there was a lot of paper saying, well, all this global warming stuff is false, the planet's not warming. There was a lot of hand-wringing in the scientific community about were all our models wrong. And then since 2015, the warming has been higher. But if you take a long-term average, it's sort of reverting to a longer-term, meaning decadal average trend. So I think if you look at it at a decade-by-decade rate, hopefully it will remain somewhat constant or at least related to the speed of our emissions. If we put more emissions in the atmosphere, it'll probably go up. However, on individual, annual, even up to decadal periods, it's going to be slower or faster, because of the internal variability in the system. So I do think, and that what that means is you will see extremes that are not, it's not like we're going to get just another hurricane every year, or we'll get slightly more intense hurricanes every year. It's very difficult to show that any particular year you have something related to climate change. And that's just because of the internal variability of the system, our difficulty in predicting weather sort of writ large to predicting sort of next year's averages, climate averages.
Yes, the chaos in the atmosphere wasn't really designed to fit inside a human brain, and that makes it difficult for it to grasp. So speaking about that, you are a model guy. Do you think artificial intelligence will design and run a full Earth system model anytime soon, maybe replacing?
The interesting thing is every single artificial intelligence method to make a prediction, almost all of them, I won't say every single one, but almost all of them, and certainly all the ones you're hearing about now, they actually have to be trained on essentially observations and models. So they have to be trained on a model that uses observations and processes the observations to come up with our best estimate of the system. So those artificial intelligence models are basically trained on the models that we build and the tools we use to process the data to constrain those models. I think there are lots of places where artificial intelligence will help us. I don't think they're going to fully replace the modeling. They will help us with techniques and tools to get better use of our data and to better constrain our models, and they already are. I'm sort of actively engaged in several of those efforts at different levels. Is that going to totally get rid of the scientist in the loop? No, because the scientist is still telling the system how to work, and we still have to use the data that we have and all the knowledge of physics as we have to present that in a way that can be we can generate training data. It's going to have a number of effects that are definitely going to improve our ability to forecast. Is it going to happen? Is that going to be a qualitative improvement or just we'll get a little bit better? I don't know yet. That's one of the interesting things that's happening right now.
I could picture artificial intelligence fed with all the eyes from the satellites at some point coming back and saying, say, did you know that at 10 o'clock in North America, energy rates go way up, and if you could spread it over 20 minutes, you'd save a lot of heating? I think it may come up with its own questions and patterns.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a long road because in order to train it, we still have to define the physics of the problem for the artificial intelligence, and that still requires basically us to encode it in a modeling system. So the artificial intelligence will help us process the data. It'll help us get the data into the model. It will help constrain the result, and then we will do that and run a model and a couple of the individual simulations. And right now we have to run the model 50 times to generate possible futures where we perturb the initial data because we don't know the actual temperature everywhere. And that's where you get probabilities of, like, the probability of rain tomorrow is going to be 50%. It's because we're running the model 50 times and 25 of those will come up with rain at a particular location. With artificial intelligence, doing that's a lot faster. So once you've trained the model, you can run it 1,000 times. That will give you better statistics. We still need the observations, and we still need a way to encode what we know about the Earth system. It's not efficient to use artificial intelligence to do that. We shouldn't throw out the physics we know.
And what are you working on next?
What are we working on next? Some of it is exactly this problem of using artificial intelligence to, say, better understand our cloud observations and encode them in models so we can actually generate, say, better predictions of rain. That's one of the projects I'm working on now. So I'm actively engaged in trying to understand how we use all the artificial intelligence.
From Pacific Northwest Laboratory, we've been speaking with Earth scientist Dr. Andrew Gettleman, and you can find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for spending time with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. I really appreciate it. Appreciate your time.
What just happened to our climate science interviews will continue over the next few programs. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.